Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, have cancer? Maybe cutting it out or burning it out isn't the best medicine. The Washington Post published a health and science article last week that intrigued us. It reports that some cancer is best treated with a lighter, more limited touch. The fighting cancer patient metaphor is falling out of favor, the article says, not only because it subtly blames patients who lose the fight, but also because it doesn't capture a world of new biological insights. Researchers at cancer centers like the U of M's Masonic Research Center and others are experimenting with new approaches to treating cancer. And Minnesota now has a state-funded cancer consortium that gives patients in rural Minnesota access to cancer trials. So how is this less is more idea affecting patients here? Two guests, your experience with cancer. Have you made a decision after a cancer diagnosis to moderate the treatment, to do less than an all-out treatment because of the treatment side effects? What did you learn from that experience? So if you've been through this and you've had to make these choices and these decisions, I think your experience and your voice would be really important to the conversation. If you've come out on the other side with some wisdom about making a decision about how you would treat the cancer, we'd like to hear from you as well. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Dr. Douglas Yee is with us. He's director of the Masonic Cancer Center at the University of Minnesota and with us today from Minneapolis. Dr. Yee, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you very much for including me.
Dr. Larry Norton is with us. He's an oncologist and medical director at the Lauder Breast Center at Sloan Kettering, and he's with us today from New York City. And Dr. Norton, welcome back to the show. It's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, great pleasure to be back. Thank you.
Dr. Norton, is this all about the advent of precision or personalized medicine, or is there more to it?
Well, I think it's a very interesting topic, and that's what's great about radio is you can actually talk about things and not reduce complex ideas to just simple phrases. We've always tried to be precise in our treatment. It's just that we're getting more precise because we're developing a better understanding of the underlying biology of cancer. Nobody went into this to try to hurt people. We're trying to help people, and it's true that sometimes what you need to cure the disease or to optimize somebody's survival of the disease is strenuous treatment that does have side effects, but it's not always true. And I'm just going to give you one example, and I'm sure Doug, a longstanding colleague and friend of mine, is going to have views on this as well. Mm-hmm. We recently saw the results of a study called Taylor X in breast cancer that looks at the activity of a small handful, a couple of dozen genes, and based on this can look a patient in the eye and say, you have an excellent prognosis, and all you need is a simple hormone, relatively non-toxic hormone treatment to achieve that, and chemotherapy is not only not necessary, but it won't improve your prognosis because it's already so good.
Wow.
I mean, that's a wonderful piece of news.
Yeah.
On the other hand, and I just want to emphasize the other side of this, some patients we can say that based on this test, chemotherapy will help you and will help you a lot and will also bring you in the category of an excellent prognosis. Just like the patients who don't need the chemotherapy, but you do need chemotherapy to get there. So it's kind of important information for both sides of the issue, and that's what I want to emphasize, is sometimes you need a more aggressive approach, but you don't often need an aggressive approach, and that's one of the things we're learning. The main lesson there for me, and it's the last thing I'll say on this before I pass it on to Doug, is that when I was going through medical school, just the word cancer already sent shockwaves of fear through everybody, the doctors and the patients and the family and everybody, because just the word cancer meant really bad prognosis and sometimes very difficult therapies before actually achieve that very bad diagnosis. And the very fact that we can actually now take somebody with a breast cancer and be able to say we've analyzed the DNA, we've analyzed the RNA, and on the basis of what we now know, it is not a bad disease. Your odds of being cured are great. You don't need very much treatment to achieve that. That changes the definition of cancer in my mind,
right.
And I think in the minds of a lot of patients I've spoken with. And I think that's a very important part of this new revolution in modern cancer medicine.
Yeah, Dr. Yee, I think we'll hear more about that from listeners here who have been through it. But I just wanted to mention that I was reading about that study that Dr. Norton was talking about on the breast cancer study. I think it was funded in part by the breast cancer stamp.
Yes, I think that's correct.
Here's my question about this. Do you still get into this, idea where a patient might say, better safe than sorry? Yes, I have to tolerate, months of chemotherapy, but we're still somewhat in a mindset of do it all. I want to believe the research, but it's my life we're talking about here.
Yeah, no, I agree with Dr. Norton that we don't have to have that option anymore. And I think a little bit as the oncologists have some responsibility for that argument, because for many years we couldn't distinguish between patients who needed certain therapies. So we tended to be a little bit more aggressive than needed. Now, I will also say every oncologist had a certain tension. They knew that was wrong. They knew there were certain patients who didn't need the chemotherapy and hormone therapy, in this case, of breast cancer. I don't think it was until the time that we had better analytic tools to start to take apart the cancer and really ask the question, does this tumor need the chemotherapy? Will it benefit at all? And that's where the Taylor X study came from, and the assay that founded that, as well as another assay we call the 70-gene assay from a different trial called MINDAC, help us understand that the biology of the tumor drove our discussion. So when I have patients say that come in with a very low Oncotype score, which is the score that was used in the Taylor X, or also called the 21-gene assay, and say, well, I just really want chemotherapy too, we can pull out the manuscripts and papers and show the chemotherapy, if anything, is more likely to harm that patient than to benefit.
So I hear you saying you will come back to a patient who still has the better safe than sorry mindset and say, it's not in your best interest, and here's what you ought to understand about the research. Is that right?
That's right, and now we have the data and the studies to say that. Up until some of these studies were published, we would say, well, yes, we really don't know. And that was one of the things that Dr. Norton pointed out, was that the paper for the area of uncertainty that was published earlier this summer really identified the fact that now we are certain chemotherapy really doesn't benefit the vast majority of patients who have estrogen receptor positive breast cancers.
Yeah. On Twitter here, a listener says, moderate treatment. My husband has cancer. I believe the chemo made things worse, from his health to the cancer becoming more aggressive. To the phones to Daniel listening in Bird Island. Hi, Daniel. Appreciate you waiting.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling you from the combine, so I'll try to keep the noise down.
I'm glad you heard the show.
In 2014, my son was diagnosed with leukemia, and he went through two rounds of chemotherapy, and the oncologist, even though he said we can't really see any cancer in him yet, to be rather safe than sorry, he should go through a round of radiation. He did not survive, but the treatment, I believe, is what killed him. I think if we'd have brought him home after the two rounds of chemo, he'd still be here.
Dr. Norton, Daniel, I'm really glad you heard the show and you had a moment to call in. Dr. Norton, what do you say to patients who say the treatment's worse than the cure, than the disease?
Well, I mean, there's several issues that are raised here, and obviously it's a very sad story. And, I'm sitting here very saddened to hear that the patient didn't do well. Leukemia is one of those diseases that, you have to get rid of the very last leukemic cell or it comes back, and sometimes you can't see that last leukemic cell in any test, even a bone marrow test, and so you have to push a little bit further to make sure that it's gone, because it does come back, and leukemias are often curable, but they do require very strenuous therapy. But I can't comment about an individual case. Obviously, this is not one would have to really look carefully at the records to comment on can't comment on that. In terms of the idea that chemotherapy can make cancers act worse, we actually have not seen evidence of that in all of the research we've done. We're talking about really tens of thousands of patients that we've looked at. The big danger of cancer therapy is not getting rid of the cancer, so the cancer comes back, and the cancer really does bad things. I've heard that statement that the treatment is worse than disease, and
yeah,
that's often from people who haven't seen what happens to untreated cancer and don't really know how bad cancer was in the 19th century or the early 20th century before we had anything that was really affected. But I have seen that. I have seen patients who've refused treatment completely, for example, or patients from parts of the world where no treatment is available. And you know, the reason why cancer has had a bad reputation for many, many centuries, and that's because the disease itself can be really terrible and you know, not only lethal, but also, you know, painful and disruptive to the entire quality of your life. So, you know, we try to use the minimum therapy necessary to maximize the chance of getting a good result with any individual case. I don't know the details of this particular case, but I'm certainly sorry that it didn't work out for the patient.
Lynn says on Twitter, yes, in 2005, diagnosed stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the doctor suggested trying a relatively new immunotherapy treatment using Rituxan alone. I had a full response without surgery or chemo, still well, though the disease is not curable. So grateful for immunotherapy treatment and research. Dr. Yi, I want to understand some of the biology of this. Is it true that each individual person's cancer is going to have a unique DNA profile, and that is why researchers such as yourselves are now diagnosing or sequencing these cancer tumors? Is that right?
Yes, I will just comment that everybody pretty much has the same DNA makeup. Most of our genomes are very close to being identical with some differences. Obviously, we don't all look the same, but for some of the major genes, they're very similar. Cancer cells mutate over time, and that's been our challenge. Different mutations cause different biologies and different clinical behaviors of cancer. We now have the tools to begin to pull that apart. The things Dr. Norton and I were talking about was what's called a gene expression profiling in breast cancer, where we just see it when the tumor is taken out, what genes are actually being expressed and how they're dictating biology.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we're entering a whole new world of having the technology be able to sequence the entire human genome. I will also say sometimes technology moves ahead of clinical science. We're starting to generate those kinds of pieces of information for patients, but I don't think we completely understand how to use them in most cases. Now, having said that, very early on in our field of breast cancer, and Dr. Norton was a participant in these studies, we understood one genome alteration, the amplification of a gene called HER2, was an extraordinarily important target in breast cancer. We developed new therapies against that particular target, and I think we really changed the way HER2-positive patients are treated and the long-term outcome and prognosis. So the ability to actually look at all these abnormalities and tumors is really powerful, but we really need to put our heads together to understand how we make a right clinical decision based on those abnormalities.
So this is my question then, given what you've just said. Once the sequencing is done, what kinds of things, and I think you alluded to this when you said we're looking at how the genes are being expressed, but explain it so that we understand what a specialist would be looking for in deciding how a particular cancer in a person's being treated. I mean, what decisions are you going to make about that?
Sure. There are certain genes that are enzymes. They catalyze a biological activity. So a very oversimplification is this, is there a switch, and the switch is normally on or off. Some mutations cause the switch to be on. If the switch is on, it's very possible that the drug could help suppress that signaling through that switch, and that has been successful in a variety of different diseases so far. You know, the most famous was chronic myelogenous leukemia, or CML, where we learned the abnormality in the switch called ABL was an excellent target for cancer therapy. We're not completely settled on all the other switches that could be targetable,
okay.
But I think that's the exciting part. We're starting to discover what they could be, and what the strategies are to address this.
And Dr. Norton, when we talk about switches, we're talking about how the genes may switch on or switch off. What do you really mean by that when it comes to cancer?
Well, it's getting so interesting. We know that all cells in the body require an instruction set. The instruction set's in the DNA, a particular molecule that, you know, we inherit half of it from our mother, half from our father, and it gives us the instruction set that tells each cell in our body how to work. But mm-hmm. All the cells in our body are different. So why, if a skin cell has the same DNA that a bone cell has, why does in one case it becomes skin and in the other case it becomes bone? And that's because even though the DNA is the same in both those cells, in some cells pieces of that DNA are turned on and make RNA, which makes proteins, which makes the cell behave in a certain way. In other parts of the body, different parts of the DNA are turned on. And these are very complicated. These are very complicated processes. We're still working on the level of complication. But you need that level of complication because the human body is very complicated. You know, there are more cells in any one person's human body than all stars in the known universe.
Wow.
All this amazing amount of complexity, you just need very, very complex systems to be able to control things. What happens in cancer is the DNA goes wrong, and it can go wrong because the instruction set itself changes. We call that a mutation. Mm-hmm. Or because the turning on and the off, in other words, genes may be overactive, like in the HER2 situation that Dr. Yee just mentioned. It's normal HER2, but it's in too great an amount, and therefore it signals the cell to divide too much, for example. So the turning in, on again and the off again of genes are made out of DNA, is really what makes all of our cells different, and it's also what, when it goes wrong, when the system goes wrong, is what makes cancer cells behave cancerous.
Got it. Dr. Larry Norton with us today, if you've just gotten in on the show, from Memorial Sloan Kettering, and Dr. Douglas Yee with us from the University of Minnesota. We've asked them to come in and talk to us today about an interesting piece I read in the Washington Post last week that is reporting on how cancer is being treated with a, as the article put it, with a lighter and a more limited touch. We've asked Drs. Yee and Norton, what is it that specialists and researchers now understand about cancer and DNA and gene sequencing that allows them to more personalize the treatment? What does that mean for the patient? I mean, how we're understanding a bit of the biology here, but also about how doctors and patients are making decisions about this. I want to know if you've made a decision after a cancer diagnosis to moderate the treatment. What kind of advice did you get from your physician, from your specialist, to do less than an all-out treatment because of the treatment's side effects, because of the new research that we're learning? And what did you learn from that experience? 651-227-6000. By the way, if you're also in this field, if you're a physician, a researcher, a specialist, would be interesting to hear your views on this as well. I know a lot of you listen to the show when you can. 800-242-2828. And on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. To Jessamine, listening in Plymouth. Hi, Jessamine. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to call about my father-in-law who died of glioblastoma, mm-hmm. which a number of high-profile people have died of, and it's terminal. And what bothered me the most is that my father-in-law went through about 9 months of treatment where the doctor never mentioned stopping, and it was his nurse that finally said, this isn't working for you, it's not improving your quality of life, I think you need to stop.
And did you feel that that gave your father-in-law and the rest of the family a kind of what permission to make a decision like this?
It did. It helped because my husband and I said, you know, maybe you should consider it at one point. And it was not easy for us to say that, but it was because the doctor was remaining positive, it wasn't heard as realistic. So there is a fine balance between, you know, hope and reality.
Dr. Norton, how do you manage that with your patients?
The fine balance is the key there. I mean, it is sometimes a very difficult thing to know when to stop treatment. And on the other hand, it's also very, very important to know what's best for the patient in terms of the quality of the life that they have and all the other aspects of this complicated situation. So I've seen both sides of that. And end-of-life care is a very, very important issue when it's clear that the medicines are not extending life or extending quality of life, to know when to stop the anti-cancer part of the treatment. But as we always say to patients, just because I'm not giving you any anti-cancer drugs doesn't mean I'm not taking care of you. Management of side effects from previous treatments, but also management of the symptoms, pain, and other things from the disease itself is still medical therapy, and it's still very important to preserve the quality of somebody's life with great supportive care. And we've seen huge advances in supportive care in the last few years in terms of managing those symptoms, so that's important. But I've also seen the other side of the coin, too, and I think that this is not something that we talk about too much. And as a matter of fact, Dr. Yee would be interested in hearing this. It's one of the very first patients I treated with Herceptin, which is this drug that attacks the HER2 molecule that's found in overabundance in a certain percentage of cancers. One of the very first patients is a patient who was really ready for terminal care, was told she had widespread metastatic breast cancer and involving many organs, and was told that there was no further therapy for her. Herceptin was a brand new drug, and in combination with a chemotherapy drug she actually had received before, in combination with Herceptin, she had a fantastic response and lived many years with excellent disease control and no symptoms, because she tried something new, at the end, when she easily could have given up hope. So the decision of when to stop the anti-cancer part of the treatment and switch into supportive care is a hard one, and it's got to be made in an individual case. We can't generalize here. It's just too important, and humans are just too different, and diseases are too different, and situations are too different. So I think that the comment that was made is a very wise one. It's a delicate line. It's a delicate balance. It's often a very hard decision, but it's clearly an important decision to make. And if the decision is made to not give any anti-cancer therapy further, it doesn't mean it's a bad decision. It doesn't mean giving up. It doesn't mean, stopping the fight. I just want to add one other thing here, because you said it a little earlier, this cancer warrior business. You're right. Yeah. It does put a burden on people because, if my cancer is winning, that means I'm not fighting hard enough. And that's most often not the case. Most often people fight hard and want to get well and want to do the right treatments. But the cancer still can win. It doesn't mean it's your fault because you're not fighting hard enough. And so I also don't like that analogy to the cancer warrior concept.
Dr. Yee, that's actually something I thought that I kind of pulled out from the Washington Post article. They quoted a cancer specialist at the University of Pennsylvania who said, "Our focus historically on the war on cancer implied that more is better and decimation is desired." This is also not just, as we've noted, a shift in the way doctors are going to talk about this, but also the way patients are going to think about it, right? Just like, kill it, get it out of me, then I will know that I'm on the way to cure.
Right. I think that that's part of the legacy and actually the way our science has evolved. And I do want to thank the caller for sharing that story with us. It's always difficult to hear particular diseases that as a category don't do well, and glioblastoma is certainly one of the more worst prognosis tumors. I would comment, Carrie, you use the term personalized medicine. Mm-hmm. I actually think most oncologists think they're giving personalized medicine, and that we know the patient, we know the family, and we have the discussions about when further active treatment may not be in the patient's best interest anymore. Mm-hmm. So the idea that you always have to treat is not necessarily right. But getting back to the concept of, when I trained and when Dr. Norton was training too, we wanted to give more chemotherapy because we thought that we could attack one of the biologies of the tumor cell, and that is they have to make more DNA and they have to divide. And if we could give enough chemotherapy, that would be sufficient. And maybe that's where the fight term came from, is that we were going to give very aggressive toxic chemotherapy that eventually would eliminate every tumor cell. I think the things we've learned over the past 30 years or so is that scenario is not right. The science has moved on beyond that. We can use, in the case of breast cancer and prostate cancer, some advanced hormone therapies that are not exactly targeted like that. We've learned a lot about immunotherapy and other diseases where we're not, I won't say immunotherapies have no toxicities, but they have a different set. But it's not so much you eliminate the cancer cell with aggressive treatment, is that you engage partners in the case of immunotherapy to help deal with the tumor.
Good. I want to come back to immunotherapy because that's come up a couple times in some tweets here. But a call here from Kumar. Hi, thank you so much for waiting. I know it's been a while.
Hi, thanks so much for this great show. I just wanted to make sure to emphasize to the listeners, and I'd love to get your expert's opinion on this, the importance of getting second opinions. I'm a testicular cancer survivor, and my first doctor went with the approach that you mentioned, Carrie, that you sort of go all out and do chemotherapy as strong as you can. And then I went to a second doctor who said, no, you know, actually the better approach is to do surgery and to do a surgery that's known as the RPLMD, which turned out to be the choice that I made and which was really, I think, changed my life. And so I just think the importance of getting second opinions, especially when you hear the experts who you're seeing, not necessarily all being in uniform consensus with one another. I'll hang up and I would be happy to listen to
what Thanks so much for the excellent question. Dr. Yi, how do you think of second opinions and what do you say to patients about it?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent idea. And I always tell patients, if your doctor is concerned or objects to you getting a second opinion, that tells you something already that you probably need to see somebody else, because there isn't a single person who has smart enough or to think about all aspects of a particular individual's cancer. And I think reviewing the records and telling one's story and telling another doctor what's important to you helps us make decisions. Beyond that, I would also ask patients to always raise a question to their physician whether or not they're eligible for a clinical trial. I think when we ask patients to participate in research with us in the form of clinical trials, we express where we are in the state of the art, what questions are known and questions are unknown. And I think patients who at least have the discussion about clinical trial participation, potentially through a second opinion or potentially through their first physician, get a better understanding of what their disease is and what the key questions are in trying to make the best decision for them.
Dr. Norton, this is why I mentioned in the introduction that Minnesota now has this state-funded cancer consortium so that people who are in rural Minnesota also get access to cancer trials. How do you just ask your physician what's happening with trials? How do you get access to this?
Well, I think that's, you know, and I don't know, I'm in New York, so I don't know exactly the way it functions there. I mean, there are tools that you can look at, and the federal government, the National Cancer Institute, has clinicaltrials.gov, which, you know, where people can look. But I think Dr. Yi is making a very important point. It's very important to ask questions. It's very important to keep discussing things. To ask the doctor, you know, you've given me a good opinion, but do you think there might be other opinions, other ways of treating this particular circumstance? Sometimes even good physicians, will recommend somebody who may have a slightly different opinion, or sometimes even a radically different opinion, that the patient could talk to, so the patient can have the information they need to make the decision that's right for them. The important thing is not to be passive as a patient, but to actually be active, to ask good questions, to listen carefully to the answers to those questions, and to make good decisions on the basis of sufficient information. Now, often, you know, you can feel comfortable with the first doctor you see. You don't have to always automatically get a second opinion. You know, if things are explained carefully, if it all makes sense, it's all reasonable, and your own reading suggests that this is the right way to go, sometimes it's pretty straightforward. But if there are any questions, then getting further input is very, very important, and people should feel free to ask the questions, get the answer they need, and to speak to everybody that they have to get the information they need to make the decision that's right for them as an individual.
Doctors Yi and Norton with us here as we have a conversation about understanding cancer treatment and new research. I want to grab a call here from Michelle in Edina. Hey, Michelle, thanks so much for waiting.
Hi.
Yeah, tell me what you're thinking about with this discussion today.
Yes, thank you for the great show. I just wanted to say also thank you to all the researchers and doctors that put out that Herceptin, because I am a benefactor of that. It was just put out 10 years before I was diagnosed. So my other thought is that you have to take into account the youngness of the patient in terms of your aggressiveness. Mm. Because I was 35 when I was diagnosed, had no family history, and was healthy, you know, had no reason to expect it. And my doctors at Frauenschuh took it so seriously, and here I am about to celebrate my 10-year anniversary in December.
Excellent.
So, and I'm stage four. So, yeah.
So you're actually kind of personifying, Michelle, what I was saying about living with cancer and thinking of it as living with cancer.
Yeah, and it gives me hope to think of it as a chronic disease. It really does, because it's like this Herceptin, and then there's so much more. Now I'm on a new one. Another targeted therapy, and it's, you know, going to keep me going for a lot longer. So
I wish you the best. Thank you
so much for the call.
Dr. Yee, what do you hear in Michelle's experience and then my question about this idea of, you know, patients thinking of cancer as a chronic disease, not a terminal one always?
Yeah, no, that's a great story. And I think this is one of our biggest challenges. And one of the things that frustrates me a little bit in terms of why I don't understand why some patients have really an exceptional response to certain therapies, and they stay that way for a very long time, as opposed to patients who might have a good response at the beginning, and it's very short-lived. We're doing a research project to try to look at endogenous sources of mutation. Tumor cells continue to mutate over time, and that may be a mechanism of resistance. But I would say, you know, one of the things I think that we should think about is the ability to make cancer a chronic disease. I think every patient would like every last cancer cell eliminated from their body, and that is an important goal. But at the same time, the vast majority of our patients would benefit if we could get their tumor just to stop what they're doing, to stop growing or stop spreading. I'm old enough to be trained at an era when at the National Cancer Institute, we were taking care of a lot of AIDS patients. Mm-hmm. And at the time, AIDS was an incredibly devastating disease. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, we've evolved an AIDS therapy that we can manage this disease for long periods of time. We can't necessarily eliminate every virus particle from the body, but certainly patients now living with HIV have a better quality of life, certainly, than when I started in my training. Now, fortunately, HIV has a very limited, it's a single etiology, a single cause, and a very limited set of genes. Cancer is much harder, but I'd love to see the day where we evolve to be able to do that, control disease for very long periods of time with therapies that are not particularly tough on people.
Dr. Norton, what would you say about the chronic aspect of this?
Oh, I think these are great points, and I'm even older than Dr. Yee, so I mean I go back even further in terms of the evolution of our thinking about the disease. Mm-hmm. As I've said many times, is nobody ever died of cancer. What you die is of tumors. Mm. The cancer is forming masses that could disrupt organ function, and those masses have cancer cells in them, certainly, but also white blood cells and blood vessel cells and other cells that make it all stick together. We call fibroblasts and many other cells, and they all work together to form the tumor. If we could prevent the tumor formation, then even if you have cancer cells in you, they're not going to cause any trouble. And as a matter of fact, we're finding out that a very large number of older people do have circulating cells with mutations that are known to cause cancer. In the white blood cells, we call it clonal hematopoiesis, and it's a surprisingly high percentage of people have these tissues. One fascinating study people who had cosmetic surgery for drooping eyelids. Mm-hmm. They looked at the DNA in the eyelids, and almost nobody put suntan lotion on their eyelids, of course, so it's always exposed to ultraviolet radiation from the sun. And dozens and dozens of known cancer-causing mutations are found in normal eyelid skin, whereas cancer of the eyelid is extremely rare.
Wow!
So that one of the really exciting emerging areas in cancer medicine is not getting rid of the last cancer cell. I wrote a paper in 1997 that did a mathematical analysis that suggested that you just can't get rid of the last cell. There's always going to be something residual, but you still can cure people because those cells don't form tumors. And so one of the really exciting areas of research is how we can manipulate other cells in the body, such as white cells. That's what immunotherapy is all about. Manipulate white cells in the body so that even if cancer cells are not totally eradicated, they don't form into tumors. And then we all become basically survivors because we have a chronic disease. The cells are there, but they never make us sick.
Yeah, it's so interesting. In some ways, it echoes some of what Alzheimer's and dementia researchers are asking themselves about why some people can live with the plaques and tangles and it never develops into dementia or Alzheimer's. I guess that's a fruitful form of research here. Why some
sure,
people react and others don't. Yeah.
People with plaque in their arteries that never get heart attacks,
right.
too.
Yeah.
So that, you know, this is a very exciting new area of medicine, not just in cancer medicine, but across the board.
Call from Gail in St. Paul. Hi, Gail. Thanks so much
Hi,
for waiting.
You.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you. This is a wonderful program. And I want to, there are several things that are coming together. One is the idea of treating cancer as a chronic disease.
Mm-hmm.
The other is really understanding what is the quality of life that cancer patients and their families need and deserve, and what's the relationship with the medical team to create and sustain a high quality of life. The story I want to leave you with is my mother was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, and because of a congestive heart failure, diabetes, and a series of other issues, she couldn't have any treatment. So she lived a very full life with stage 4 lung cancer for 2 years.
Wow.
And her diagnosis, which we never talked to her about in terms of you've got 4 months to live, which is fairly quintessential of the diagnosis, but rather focused on quality of life. She went into northern Minnesota fishing. She was in the mountains of near Boulder. She went to Nova Scotia. It was fulfilling what she wanted in terms of her quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
So treatment was never an option for her. So as we think about what do we begin with? What's the question we begin with? Not one of medicine, but one of spirit and soul. And how does the team of family, doctors, practitioners come together to actually fulfill and give someone a meaningful life?
Oh, my God. That's we could do a whole show on this, Gail. So interesting. Also, because I think you said there was no horizon given to her, as in put your things together. You've probably got 5 months of good living left or something like that. Is that right?
Yes, I believe in cancer treatment, but in this case, it didn't work. And I think, so we were in Chicago at Northwestern University. I went to the University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So we had, and I'm a medical advocate, right?
Mm-hmm.
I teach medical advocacy in business schools. So for me, I was, yes, we're going to go and treat my mom and
mm-hmm.
she's going to live. But again, how do we step back and actually think about what kind of quality of care we give and not putting those deadlines on people, because that may not be the case. And as a result, our colleagues at Northwestern's are really thinking through their hospice care, their oncology, around this model that was developed around my mother's care.
Wow.
So what's holistic? How do we treat a community as well as the patient to give them the quality of life they deserve?
Dr. Yee, can I ask you what you hear in Gail's experience?
Yeah, no, that's an extremely important area, because the same prescription, so to speak, is not right for every patient. And it gets, again, back to this idea that we need to personalize our therapies based on what's important to the patient as well as other disease processes that might affect the delivery of therapy. So in my clinic, I sit in a sort of a largish room next to our palliative care team.
Mm-hmm.
And our palliative care team is involved with all of our patients with advanced cancer. And it is really a way to bring a multidisciplinary care, more than one person thinking about the patient. One of the things that Dr. Norton and I, we're oncologists, so we're very optimistic people. So we think everything is going to work all the time. And I think every once in a while, it's good to have other voices at the table. And I think your caller just mentioned this, that she was the person who was more aggressive, but other people wanted to be more aggressive with their mother, but other people might have stepped back and took a look at the situation
right. And
said, you know, that's not the right thing to do. So I do really think it takes more than one person on the care team to think about the problem, all the way from social work to physical therapy to palliative care specialists to advanced practice providers. They're all part of the team and have decision-making input.
Dr. Norton, I'm sure you have a thought on Gail's mother's experience.
Well, I mean, I think I agree with everything that's been said. Gail's comments really are superb, and Dr. Yee has really had, Doug has really summarized the feeling of most of us really in the field. I always say, you know, just sort of close this part of my reaction is that in the room there's always, you know, two experts. There's the doctor, the nurse is an expert in medicine and science, and there's the patient who's an expert in their life.
Yeah.
And together they have to come up with the decision that's right for that individual based on their knowledge. And nobody knows their life better than the patient with the help of the family members in terms of making those decisions. But there's another side of the coin. I think that it's important for us to bring this part out as well. And I just would bring it brings to mind there's an excellent book about the history of cancer written by Vincent DeVita. It's called The Death of Cancer, and it's about his early experience with developing a curative treatment for Hodgkin's disease that was a uniformly fatal disease before a certain combination of drugs was developed at the National Cancer Institute, a place that Dr. Yee and I both had experience. And there was a nihilism about the disease in those days, saying, listen, you know, you're not going to cure it. Why make people sick with drugs? You're just ruining the quality of their life. They're never going to get better. You know, you're doing a terrible thing by developing these various toxic treatments. But he persisted, and I recommend that everybody read the book to see in the early chapters how that happened.
Right.
And indeed developed not only a cure for Hodgkin's disease, but also laid the groundwork for all the other diseases that we now can cure with various drug treatments, and, you know, the beginning of where we're moving in with precision medicine, immunotherapy, and some of the more novel things that we're developing now. So sometimes it is important to fight, and it's not always let the disease take its course. You have to make an individual decision, but you also have to do the research that's going to move things forward so that individuals have a chance to be cured. Hopefully with the minimal disruption of the quality of life as can be accomplished. That's everybody's goal. But sometimes, you know, to get rid of a disease so people can live for decades and decades perfectly healthy, you do have to be tough. And so it's not one side or the other. It's a much more complicated issue. And we have to consider all of these various factors when we're making a decision that's right for the individual patient.
Yeah. Dr. Norton, we're a community of readers. I'm sure Dr. Yee knows that. So book recommendations are always welcome, and I'll tweet out the title of that book. Thanks for that. Jeff says from St. Louis Park, Larry Norton treated my mother 20 years ago. He's a fantastic humane doctor. My mother lived 20 years with cancer in the 70s. A doctor needs to be this way, and he was. And Jean in South Minneapolis. Hi, Jean.
Hi.
Hi. thanks for waiting. I know it's been a bit. What do you want to say?
Well, I just wanted to throw out my situation. I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma over 9 years ago. I started some treatments about 4 years ago. And one of the protocols is an autologous stem cell transplant. And it's almost like they prescribe that for everybody. But now they're coming out. What I'm on right now is an infusion of Darzalex, which is a monoclonal antibody. So it attacks the multiple myeloma cells. And it's working for me. And I know there's no cure for multiple myeloma, but I feel so good. And it's kind of interesting how that stem cell transplant is still such a thing that they say you have to do. And I know many people that have had it, and they have a little bit of good results. But it's very toxic. It takes almost an entire year to recover.
Wow.
So, you know, it is interesting how things are changing. So I feel pretty positive about everything.
Yeah, you were glad for the alternative to that, it sounds like, Jean. I'm going to grab a call from Gina in Plymouth. Hi, Gina. What's your experience with this? Are you there, Gina?
I have melanoma. I am an early stage melanoma survivor, and what I have not heard much discussed was the new science in early detection. And in my case, I just went through 6 more biopsies. 2 were atypical, but I'm kind of in a maintenance place, though I have it. I keep getting surgeries. And because we had early detection, I've been very fortunate. Mm. So I've had to mentally move myself into a chronic state of mind. And I didn't hear much discussion on all the new detection and the new tests that are coming out detecting all these different types of cancers in an earlier stage.
Okay, good question. And Dr. Yu, we've got a couple minutes left. Early detection and where that figures into this.
Sure. So this goes back a little bit to some of the things we were talking about, our ability to detect things at a very fine level. So one of the things about melanoma and skin cancers is the entire field has been exposed to the carcinogen, which is usually UV radiation, but not always. And still, the best detection method is frequent evaluation by dermatologists. Similarly, another cancer that we know is associated with smoking, there's early detection strategies now for lung cancer, which includes CT scanning. But the other methods that are coming, and I think are very interesting still research-wise, are can you detect any circulating blood-based, either mutated DNA, as Dr. Norton mentioned, in the bloodstream, or even circulating tumor cells, which can be detected. There are nationally very large studies attempting to address this question. I'm aware of the one in breast cancer where tens of thousands of women will have blood drawn along with their screening mammography to determine if a blood and mammography can do a better job of detecting early stage cancer.
I didn't know that. So, Dr. Norton, some of the traditional screening?
It ties together.
Yeah.
I know we only have a couple more minutes left. It ties together because if we can find a what I was concerned about the circulating DNA work is that we can find that yes, you have a mutated DNA, but we don't know where it's coming from, so we don't know what to do about it. The emerging technology is really rather remarkable because by analyzing the DNA fragments in great detail, we often can tell that it's a mutation and where the organ it's coming from is, so that we can be more specific. But you imagine that if we could identify mutant DNA and we know that that mutation maybe is associated with the causation of the cancer, we call it pathogenesis, the causation of the cancer, and we have a drug that can attack that specific causation, then we could prevent it from forming a cancer in the first place. So early detection now comes together with therapy, that is a medicine, but in a form that's actually prevention, very early intervention and prevention.
Wow.
So it's like not waiting for someone to get a heart attack, but you say your cholesterol is high, so I'll give you a pill and lower your cholesterol and you'll never get the heart attack. It's an early diagnosis by looking at the cholesterol. It's a medical intervention, which is a statin, and the effect is actually preventing a disease. And as we've done that with heart disease, I think there's every reason to believe that sooner rather than later, we're going to be able to do the same thing with cancers.
You know, Dr. Yu, in the minute that we have, is drug therapy keeping up? That was something I was curious about.
In prevention?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit behind. I think drug therapy and prevention is hard because just statistically, you have to treat tens of thousands of patients potentially, and the drug has to be pretty safe. So it's been a little bit harder, you know, the recent reports about mini-dose aspirin not protecting against cancer is an example of one of the things that we had hoped would work, but may not when it's applied to a large population.
Dr. Douglas Yee with us, director of the Masonic Cancer Center at the University of Minnesota. Hey, thank you so much for the time and the insight. Really good to have you on the show.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Larry Norton, medical director of the Lauder Breast Center. And Dr. Norton, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you all so much.
If you caught just the last part of the show, wow, lots of good insight and experience from our physicians, and you can find it on the podcast and listen to it at your leisure. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.